All right, Alexander. So we've been hearing now for a while that Russia is amassing troops on the border with Ukraine, and they're about to invade. When in reality, we actually have Ukraine soldiers amassing on the borders with the East, with the Donbass. And it looks like they may be preparing for something, or maybe they're waiting for the green light from the U.S. Maybe they're being pushed to amass those troops on the border by the U.S. Maybe it's posturing. Maybe it's the neocons behind it. Who knows? But the way things are shaping out, it's actually looking like all of this has been kind of a projection narrative where they're saying Russia's amassing, where the reality is that Ukraine is definitely moving a lot of troops towards that border with the East, perhaps in anticipation for something. I believe there was a Kremlin Peskov.
Peskov,
did say that they are seeing this and they are worried. Absolutely. What's your take on this?
Absolutely. And by the way, the people in charge, the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics are talking about this as well. They're saying that they're also noticing this big build-up of forces by Ukraine as well. And bear in mind that Ukraine has also been calling up reserves, and including women. I mean, very interestingly, I mean, these are reports I'm getting that they've actually been trying to call up women because they can't find enough young men, presumably, to fill up the numbers. So there's been this big concentration of Ukrainian troops. Now, I think it's possible that way back in the autumn, until a short while ago, I think there may have been a genuine plan for Ukraine to launch an offensive in eastern Ukraine. And it's still possible that that might happen. If it happens, the Russians have again made it clear that they will respond and respond decisively. I mean, there's been, if you go back to what Peskov was saying, he was basically saying that, you know, if there is a Ukrainian attack on the Donbass, it will be disastrous for Ukraine. I think that if that plan exists, it's probably been dropped over the last couple of hours. And I will say why. Because firstly, we have negotiations underway now in Paris between Ukrainians, Russians, Germans, French. And the word at the moment is that the French, and Macron is leading some sort of diplomatic initiative. He's apparently intending to speak to Putin himself shortly, that the French are trying to defuse the situation. They want some kind of a pullback from the front lines. They want an exchange of prisoners, and they want the Ukrainians to drop plans for a law that they're trying to impose on the Donbass. And I think the French are doing all of this, and the Germans are doing all of this, because from their point of view, they do not want to see a crisis, a military conflict in Ukraine that forces them to impose sanctions on Russia, which would be disastrous for themselves. So you see this growing divergence now between the Europeans and the Americans and the Europeans on the one hand and the Americans and the British on the other. Even Josep Borrell is now saying, he seems to be, you know, the absolutely crass, incompetent, fervidly anti-Russian EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs. He also is saying, you know, that there isn't going to be a war anytime soon. And I think the reason, as I said, is they don't want to see the situation escalate in that way. And I think that the Ukrainians themselves are now starting to get cold feet about this. There's been a whole series of statements over the last couple of hours from Ukrainian officials. You had Zelensky telling people don't panic. You've had Danilov, the head of Zelensky's Security Council, says, you know, that there's no war is imminent and that the Russian troop movements beyond the border are entirely normal and that they don't amount to anything. We've seen the Ukrainian defense minister, a man called Reznikov, coming out this morning and also saying that he doesn't anticipate any kind of war anytime soon, not even after the Beijing Olympics are ended. He says the prospects of that are low. Now, it seems to me that the Ukrainians would not be talking like this if they were really planning an offensive at the moment. And my sense is that they're coming under enormous pressure from the Germans and the French to pull back from any wild ideas they might have, because, as I said, the Germans and the French know that there would be a devastating Russian counter-response, and the Germans and the French don't want to be pushed into imposing sanctions on Russia, which would immediately come back and bite themselves. So I think that the possibility is there. I think that that plan might very well have existed. I think there are probably still some people, especially in Washington and London, and to some extent perhaps in Kiev, who want it to happen, and it might still happen. But I think on balance that it won't.
Right. I agree with that. You had the mayor of Kiev, the former boxing champ, Klitschko, who said Klitschko. That Germany has betrayed Ukraine.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not the sharpest knife in the draw. No. Just, I mean, if anyone's heard the interviews with him, he's not exactly the smartest guy in the room. But anyway, he's a high-profile famous boxer, and he said that that Germany has betrayed Kiev. Well, Klitschko, I've got news for you. Germany betrayed you when they pushed you into the coup in 2014, promising you European Union membership, and then stabbed you in the back with Nord Stream 2. But anyway,
that's just for
Klitschko to digest. Yeah. Yeah. They haven't betrayed you now. They betrayed you many, many years before. Yeah. But, you know.
You were a fool to trust them. I mean, you're a fool to trust them. I mean,
they got played. They got played.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Merkel played them perfectly.
Absolutely.
Merkel played them perfectly.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. And they still want to get it to the European Union, which just goes to show how crazy it is. You know, the worry is that the neocons will somehow trigger something, right?
Yes.
Or some crazy, you know, neo-Nazi in the Ukraine government, which is full of them.
Absolutely.
They actually do something in order to save a country in meltdown. So that is the worry. But my question to you is, even if they do launch some sort of offensive against the East, everything that we say and everything that all the analysts says, the Russian government and military already knows about it. I'm sure they know every single move the Ukrainian army is making. So, I mean, when we say this, I'm sure the Russians already have said, already know this. They've already game planned this out. They already have the intelligence as to anticipate what might happen. I mean, they already have the whole thing game planned. So even if they do launch some sort of attack on the Donbass, is it definite that Russia will actually go full in for an invasion like the U.S. wants them to do? I don't think so. I think Russia may respond, and they may respond with force, but I think it may be some sort of a surprise response maybe. I mean, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there to you. I don't see them going in and sweeping through the country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it depends very much what form this invasion, this attack takes.
Right.
I mean, if it's a full-scale attack on by the Ukrainians on the Donbass, a real attempt to roll it over, well, then at that point, I think the Russians would respond not just in a limited way, but they might launch a full-scale counteroffensive. There's been a suggestion from, I think it was either Anatole Levin or Dmitry Symes about what they might do in that case, that they might occupy all of eastern Ukraine all the way down to Odessa, say that they're not actually annexing the country or setting up any kind of thing like that, but then offering negotiations with the Western powers based upon essentially the Minsk agreement for the setting up of a new government and a decentralized formula and new elections and all those sort of things. The Russian troops would then pull back and the Minsk agreement would be implemented in the way the Russians have said. I mean, it could be that kind of scenario. But if it's a more limited offensive, which, by the way, I suspect that's all that the Ukrainian military in its present form is capable of.
Do you think the Ukraine really can move hundreds of thousands of troops at this moment in time?
Right. Back, you remember when there was that previous concentration of Ukrainian troops last year, at the beginning of last year? At that time, I thought they could. Since then, I've been getting much more information about the state of the Ukrainian military. And to be straightforward about it, I don't think they can. My understanding is that this is an army which is very disorganized, very demoralized, lots of cynicism in its ranks, and which most of its best units, such as they are bogged down in trench warfare on the conflict line with the Donbass. I don't think they're capable of launching the kind of, you know, sweeping offensive that I once thought that they could do. So, you know, it would be probing attacks, it would be attempts to capture some villages, there'd probably be intense fighting around those villages, there'd be shelling from each side. The Russians would then complain about it to the Security Council, the Security Council would be deadlocked. The Russians would then retaliate, probably with massive artillery barrages from across the Russian border, which they can easily do. That would obliterate large Ukrainian units. It would all be very messy and very unclear. And that's the point where, of course, there'd be disagreements, the kind of disagreements Biden was hinting about whether that was a real Russian intervention or invasion of Ukraine. And then you'd see all the chaos and muddle on the part of the Western powers about whether in that kind of situation they should impose sanctions or not, what Biden was alluding to in his press conference. It seems to me that this is the more realistic scenario. It's not the one I'd thought of previously, because to be straightforward about it, I'd rated the Ukrainian military higher than perhaps it deserves. But my understanding from, you know, people who've been reporting about it is that it's not really in any kind of position to launch that any a sustained offensive or to engage in maneuver warfare as it, you know, as it would need to be if it was really to win a war in the Donbass this time. So realistically, it would be a more limited war, in which case perhaps the Russians wouldn't advance all the way to Odessa, as I once thought they would.
All right. So Ursula von der Leyen announced that she would be giving $1.2 billion
yeah.
to Ukraine in order to bail them out from their financial difficulties, which yeah. we mentioned a yeah. couple of days ago.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, after we posted that video, the EU came out with the announcement, we're going to give more money to Ukraine to help them out because their economy is
tanking,
collapsing.
Absolutely, it's tanking.
So, you know, great for EU citizens that we're going to give yeah. money to Ukraine. And of course, I'm sure that money is going to be put to good use by the oligarchs in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it'll find its way back to the kleptocrats in Brussels as well. But anyway, so you can see yeah. how there's definitely a profit motive
yeah.
to all this theater that we're seeing.
Yeah,
and I think we've seen the first hint of that with the money from the European Union going yeah. to Ukraine. You also have Stoltenberg saying that, you know what, you know, we got all this stuff going on in Ukraine, but perhaps NATO really needs to boost its eastern flank and consider Sweden and Finland a little more closely to entering the alliance. And if they can't get Finland, which the population of Finland seems to be very resistant to NATO, well, maybe at the end of the day, when all is said and done, at least NATO gets Sweden in. And, you know, it's a win for Stoltenberg. It's a win for NATO. They've expanded by one country, and they wait another few more years to stoke up some more Russian fear. Maybe they can grab another country into the alliance. Of course, it won't be the southern countries, but you know, you also have that in the news. So maybe you can start to see some of the angle with NATO as well, perhaps,
yeah.
in all this. Maybe,
yes.
you know,
yes.
they come out of this at least with a Sweden or
yes.
maybe even a Finland in hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is possibly the game. But I think it's inconceivable Finland would join NATO, to be straightforward about it. I think it's possible that Sweden might, but I don't think it's going to happen, because my own sense is that this particular crisis is starting to ebb now. And I still think there's too much opposition, even in Sweden itself, to doing this. So I don't think it's going to happen. But it's interesting that Stoltenberg, who remember is Norwegian, Norway used to be united with Sweden, you know, they're very close countries. It's interesting that Stoltenberg wants this. And by the way, I mean, I understand Stoltenberg isn't terribly popular in Norway itself. So, I mean, you know, there's all these tensions there, all these plans. But let's just focus, let's just talk about the economics of this, because What we see is the extent to which Ukraine is now surviving on European life support. It can't. It's not sustainable on its own resources. So we were talking about this run on Ukrainian banks, the fact that Ukraine can't raise funds in the international money markets because people aren't lending to it anymore. The worry about this court case that's winding its way in London, which could declare Ukraine in default, all of those things. So what do the Europeans do? Well, they come up with another $1.2 billion. And be very clear, that's only one. They're going to give more and more and more. But there is another dimension to this. And here I'm going to say that this is a developing thing. I'm not completely clear about this, but one of the great mysteries to me is why, despite the fact that we've had a very warm winter up to now in Europe, the reserves in the gas reserves in Europe's underground gas supply system are still falling and are now at absolute record lows. Why is this happening? Well, I'm starting to get seeing reports that what's actually happening is that because Ukraine actually ran out of gas in November, the Europeans have been sending gas to Ukraine via the Yamal pipeline. So that is draining Europe of gas. I mean, that in order to keep Ukraine, you know, Ukraine's homes lit. And if that is so, one wonders, you know, if the real cold snap hits Europe, which it might do. I mean, you've had snow in Turkey and Greece and Cyprus. If the cold weather starts to really hit in Europe over the next couple of weeks, and it turns out that European consumers are unable to get heating fuel, and you know European factories have to stop working because European gas has been sent via the Yamal pipeline back to Ukraine in order to keep the Ukrainians going. Well, that shows you how costly this whole Ukrainian enterprise is actually becoming. That's a much bigger subsidy to Ukraine than the odd $1 billion here and there, which, as you absolutely rightly said, is going to end up in people's private accounts in Zurich and Geneva and in the Turks and Caicos and the Maldives and all these places, the Isle of Man, all these places where people squirrel away, Ukrainian oligarchs squirrel away their money.
Yeah, I can tell you right now, there is no heat in my apartment in Greece with the cold spell. I mean, they haven't been able to provide heat, so I fully believe that the Europeans have been subsidizing Ukraine so that the Ukraine project that they started with the coup that they instigated along with Obama in 2014, they are trying to prevent that from collapsing, and it's coming at the cost of EU citizens. The EU citizens are paying for these loans to Ukraine, and they're paying in higher energy prices because the energy that should be going to them is actually going to Ukraine so that these kleptocrats in Brussels don't have their Ukraine project fall apart.
Exactly. That's exactly. That is exactly what I think, by the way. I think this is exactly why we are, because it doesn't really make sense that, as I said, with this very warm winter that we had, that European gas reserves have fallen so fast over the last few weeks. Where is all that gas going? Well, I think it's going to Ukraine. I mean, Putin himself said it was going to Ukraine. I mean, Putin actually said that a couple of weeks ago. And I suspect that he's right. And that explains why people in Greece and Cyprus are now cold. By the way, I understand that there's gas and energy shortages in Turkey too. Now, I don't think that's connected to this directly, but it does make me wonder what exactly is going on in Turkey and why Turkey's also experiencing outages at this time.
Yeah. On a final note, going back to Macron to close out the video, Eric Zemmour came out with a statement And we have the elections coming up now in France. And he said that he would pretty much roll back all the sanctions against Russia, get into dialogue with Russia, and put all this nonsense to bed. In other words, all this Russia hating and this Russia sanction stuff, he would be done with it. I imagine that's putting a lot of pressure on Macron. And that's probably one. I'm not saying it's the only reason, but I'm sure that's one of the reasons for Macron to take the pole position in trying to broker some sort of arrangement. Obviously, the United States is not invited to this, which is interesting. No. But here you have Macron kind of saying, you know what? If I don't do something and show that I'm the statesman of Europe, I'm the leader of France in Europe, and I'm going to also stop with this Russia sanctions nonsense because my opponents are taking a position, no more sanctions against Russia, let's end this nonsense, I at least have to, you know, meet them halfway in order to secure some sort of possibility to get reelected. I'm sure that's kind of one of the reasons for Macron to take this stance and to say, let's sit down and let's solve this. Because, you know, we bash Macron a lot, but on this instance, he really has taken a pole position. And he's broken away from the Anglosphere of countries which are pushing for war. It's the Anglosphere pushing for war. And then you have the German and the French, and really Macron's been at the forefront. They're the ones that are saying, we need to sit at the table and sort this out.
What you're saying is indisputably true. And we see the extraordinary electrifying effect that the appearance of Zemmour has had in the elections. It's forced the left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, to come out and say straightforwardly that France needs to leave NATO and align with Russia. Now, that he's doing that, Mélenchon is doing that, because, of course, what's happening is that working-class French voters who used to support the left like what Zemmour is saying. They like what Zemmour is saying, both on immigration, but they also like what he's saying on foreign policy. So Mélenchon has to harden up the left's positions on this. But, of course, it's also having this decisive effect on Macron, because Macron understands, as all French leaders now understand, that this election, which is coming up in France, is going to be won on the right. And it is Zemmour who is making the big noises, who's essentially making the weather, if you like, the political weather on the right. It is his narratives that are beginning to cut through and which are being bought into by French voters. And you have to understand that in France, attitudes towards Russia, especially outside the, you know, the cognoscenti, the elites in Paris, if you're talking about attitudes to Russia in, you know, La France profonde, they are profoundly different from what you would find in, say, you know, the Anglosphere, or in parts of the Anglosphere. People there tend to see Russia as, you know, a country with which France has on many occasions been on good terms. And, you know, they look back upon the time of de Gaulle, when de Gaulle sought good relations with Russia. So this is a popular policy with many people in France. And Macron is forced to adjust to it because he has to win that election in April. So that's why he's trying to broker these deals with Putin. That's why he's putting all these spokes on the whole business of Western unity. He understands that this is the policy he has to follow if he's going to win over support from the French in the elections in the spring. It may not be enough, by the way. I'm far from convinced it will be. And French elections can throw up unexpected outcomes. And whereas a few weeks ago, I did look to me as if Zemmour was really not in with a chance, and I thought that Macron was likely to win. Well, it's beginning to look as if Macron is in difficulties. And Pécresse, the centre-right candidate that had been built up as being the alternative to Macron, she seems to be fading, with Zemmour making the weather.
Very interesting developments all around with regards to the story. All right, theduran.locals.com, Odyssey, BitChute, Rumble, and Super U, and go to the Durant shop, 10% off. Use the code GOODDAY. Take care.